Session number 858.
Major General Gordon Hall, Reel 1. General, why did you want to join the Royal Tank Corps?
Because I had originally been intended by my family to go into the Gordon Highlanders. And I interviewed the colonel of the Gordon Highlanders when I was at Sandhurst. And I was accepted, but I had felt all along that I would have been more appropriately placed in a mechanical arm, which was my main interest at that time. And so, unbeknownst to my family, I changed my application and put the tank corps as the first choice, in the belief that the tank corps at that time was the major mechanical arm of the service.
You had worked on cars and things. You'd been attracted by the mechanical side. Is that the reason?
Not to any great extent, because there weren't many cars, but I had found a 1917 Studebaker 26 horsepower in our garage, which nobody could drive at that time, and I taught myself initially to drive that by starting it and taking it up and down the drive. But beyond that, no, I had always had an interest in handicrafts, but I can't pretend to have worked on cars and motorbikes and things at that stage.
At Sandhurst, did you work on any mechanical projects?
Yes. There was a fairly recent addition to the curriculum of mechanical science, and that was divided into mechanical science A and B. I don't remember precisely what B was, but I know mechanical science that I took was to do with the elementary engineering subjects, such as machine drawing and things of that sort, and also it had a practical side, and one learnt a certain amount of brazing and soldering and things of that nature.
What was the attitude of the Sandhurst authorities to your application to join the RTC?
Well, the Sandhurst authorities really didn't have much to do with it, because except when you came to your last term and had to say what you wished your name put down for in the order of 1, 2, 3, they had to accept that. But previous to that, we had had a visit and a lecture from Sir Hugh Ellis, who was then Master General of the Ordnance, and I had spoken to my company commander, who was the late General Jumbo Wilson, and he had advised that I asked to speak to Sir Hugh Ellis after his lecture, which I did do, and I was laid up and told him my desire to join the Tank Corps, and he said, well, you can't do this as things are now, but obviously you ought to be able to, and I will go back to the War Office and try and arrange it that the Tank Corps becomes a separate arm of the service, and that people are able to be inducted direct into it. In the meantime, the best I can offer is that you will be posted to the general list and seconded to the Tank Corps.
Why did he say that you couldn't do it at present?
Because the Tank Corps was not a formed corps. It was composed entirely of people seconded from other regiments. And in fact, General Duncan, whom I remember in those days, used to appear in a kilt. And all the other officers had the fruit salad of uniforms and dresses and peculiarities which were common to the army at that time.
Did Hugh Ellis tell you much about the Tank Corps?
No, very little indeed. He had told us something in his lecture, of course, but he had never suggested that any of us might want to join it, because the thinking then was that they would get all their people from other arms by secondment.
But he was recruiting at Sandhurst?
No, I think not. It's difficult to remember precisely, but my recollection of it was that he was just there to tell people something about an arm which they knew very little about, and the public knew little about, except the highlights culled from the 1916 times onward during the war. And he didn't confine his talk, as far as I remember, to the tank corps, because he was Master General of the Ordnance and covered a number of other arms as well.
Did you then subsequently find it difficult to join the tank corps?
Oh, no. When I got my paper saying, what is your choice of regiment or arm in the following order, I put down tank corps first, Gordon Howland second, and I can't remember what was third, but I was then posted to the general list and for secondment to the tank corps.
Did you find at Bovington, when you went for training, the course difficult or effective?
Effective on a fairly low level. Difficult, no. We were taught almost entirely by sergeant instructors, because the officers at that time knew really very little about technical matters.
So you find, in fact, that your instructors were not that helpful, is that what you're saying?
No, they were helpful, but it was not the fashion then for officers to be capable of instructing in mechanical matters.
Who was doing most of that at Bovington?
Oh, the sergeant instructors.
What AFVs were you being instructed on?
Almost entirely Mark V wartime tanks. There were examples of the later ones, Mark V Star, Mark V Two Star, and I think one or two of the very latest ones, which never went into action. But the reason why we worked almost entirely on Mark V's was that there was, just outside Bovington Camp, in the region of Clouds Hill, a dump of surplus wartime Mark V tanks, many of these virtually unused. There were, I should guess, some 500 or more of these monsters lying about on the sand, and a commercial firm had obtained the contract for cutting them up and converting them to scrap. And we obviously did very much better training on Mark V's, because if we broke a track, we could go up to these people and say, will you accept a broken track from that nice new one over there, or an engine, or any other part? And so we were able to keep the tanks going without the regular supply of new spare parts from industry.
But you found that the training you got on the driving and maintenance course was effective for your later...
Very, very good for driving and maintenance. The driving and maintenance of that early type of vehicle really bore very little relation to later machines. And as an instant, I can tell you that the job of two of the tank crew was to sit with a drum of what was called steam cylinder thick, which was a dirty black oil which was used in ships for lubricating the steam cylinders. And having made a hole in this 5-gallon drum, you kept pouring it into a tin mug and then through a funnel onto the epicyclic gearing. And that was the regular method of lubricating the epicyclic gearing of a tank. Well, that was never repeated, luckily, and more sophisticated methods of lubrication came in every subsequent tank I've ever heard of.
You were posted to the 2nd Battalion at Farnborough. Could you say something about the routine of a section officer at that time?
It was intensely boring. One paraded after breakfast, probably at 9 o'clock, if it was in the winter and there wasn't an early morning pre-breakfast parade, and you inspected your section as a young officer, and you then marched them a matter of perhaps 3/4 of a mile down to the tank hangars, which were near Laffan's Plain, and there you let them loose on your section of tanks, and they spent the morning doing maintenance, so-called. They greased things, they cleaned the plugs, they started the engine and ran it for a bit, and things of that sort. The officers took very little part in this, except to go and see the stores if any special bit of equipment or any lubricants or what have you were required. Otherwise, we used to stand around in the hangar and gossip and slap our lady with a stick.
Were other regimental officers of your rank equally bored?
Well, I don't know what the captains and majors did, but I suppose they must have done more than we did. Partly because, of course, in the more senior ranks had other jobs as well. There would be a PRI, there'd be a messing officer, and all the other domestic chores of a battalion, which, of course, didn't come down to the very young officers like myself.
What was the quality of the men who were in the tank corps at this time?
I thought they were very good. They were largely 1919 recruitment, that is, men who had served during the war, had a brief look at civilian life outside, didn't like it, and then rejoined for what was the standard enlistment at the time, that's 7 and 5, 7 years with the colours and 5 years on the reserve. And many of them were first-class people.
Were many of them First World War veterans?
Oh, yes. Joining in 1919, naturally they were. There were some young people from school or what have you, but the majority of that particular induction were people who had served in the war or come in just at the end of it and seen enough to make them want to soldier, but hadn't really sort of got to grips with it.
Did you find that the other ranks were forming, the First World War other ranks, were forming as some sort of group, as a First World War group within the tank corps at this time?
No, I never noticed anything like that. The NCOs were almost all people who'd seen service, and a number of the men. There was just perhaps a third of the organisation you happened to be controlling, which were people who had recently joined and had no previous experience.
What AFVs were you working on then?
At Farnborough we had the Medium C, which was a tank rather similar to the Mark V in its mechanical details, but it was the last of a series of Whippet tanks, as they were called at that time, and was rather heavier than any of the earlier Whippets, but of course a good deal lighter and faster than the Mark V.
What exercises or tactical exercises were you doing then, do you remember?
Well, there was, as I suppose there is now, a system whereby you spent most of your time on, in the winter perhaps, on individual training, and then on training with small formations, getting up to company training, battalion training, and then in the summer, training with the remainder of the troops in the all-shot command. The training was of a very simple kind. It was, shall we say, go out on Laffan's plain and try and go across it keeping in line, or go and hide behind that wood and try not to be seen. That standard of things. There was no tactical use of armament or anything that I can remember. And we also, of course, used to go up to the ranges and fire machine guns, not the main armament, because you couldn't do that in Aldershot because it hadn't got enough safety space anywhere.
What about communications?
Communications were either by shouting through a megaphone at the tank next door, or by the ordinary flags, the Morse code flags, which had special meanings applicable to the tank corps. I mean, it was not used as Morse, but a combination of various colours meant certain things which you were supposed to know and appreciate.
But if I may return to the tactics just for one moment, there was no evidence then of the experience of the First World War being used for your exercises.
I should think the only evidence was of that. I think the idea was the tanks would behave much as they did in the First World War. They would accompany the infantry because they weren't really capable of doing much else. And the Mark V wartime tank, as far as I remember, only did about 5 miles an hour, which doesn't stretch an infantryman too badly.
Were you working with any infantrymen at this time?
Only in the collective training period.
How did that work?
Well, there were schemes worked out by Headquarters Ultra Command, and the tanks were allotted a part in it. And you went out there and presumably played that part.
But you didn't have much direct contact with the infantry officers at this time?
Not very much. You occasionally shouted at each other, but that's about all. Yeah.
Were you given any special training when you went to Belfast with the 12th Armoured Car Company for a civil peacekeeping role?
No. But the principles of duties in aid of the civil power, as it was called in the manual of military law, were taught at Sandhurst, and one was supposed to know what one could and could not do. There was then in force the late lamented Riot Act, and that involved the bringing out of a magistrate before you were able to fire, for instance. But other than that, our job was very much what it had been at Farnborough, largely training people in driving. We used to go out with our section and drive 20 or 30 miles out and back again, changing drivers all the time. And there was also a certain amount of serious patrolling in the danger areas like the Falls Road in Belfast.
What vehicles were you using?
The early Rolls-Royce armoured cars. They were fairly suitable for riot conditions. They were fast, badly armoured, but pleasant to operate. But they were not, I would say, as effective as a very primitive, lumbering old armoured car, which we also had, based on the American Peerless 3-ton lorry chassis. That had twin machine gun turrets and I think was a good deal less easy to overturn in a crowd.
You mentioned they were badly armoured. What were they armoured with, in fact?
The armour of the Rolls-Royce armoured cars is, speaking from memory, 7mm.
And you found, from your experience, that this was ineffective, did you?
No. No, I don't think I was ever shot at. But I might have been.
Yeah. But you considered at the time, when you were in them, that this was...
Oh, yes. We were perfectly happy that if people shot at you, they shot at you generally with an old 303 rifle or a revolver, and it would keep out either of those.
When you were patrolling, did you find that in terms of capacity, engine capacity, these were suitable vehicles that you were using?
Oh, yes. We didn't patrol far. Of course, the Rolls-Royce, it weighed, from memory, 3.5 tons, and the engine, which was rated at 4850 horsepower, gave just about that. Not like modern engines, which give very much more than their rated horsepower. And that was quite adequate to take the car along at 60 to 70 miles an hour, given the suitable conditions.
You would say, then, that the armoured cars that you had were effective for the use
that
you intended?
Yes, they were not proof against bullet splash, which is a thing which people became very conscious of later on. But at that time, it was not a major worry because you were not shot at by machine guns in Ireland in those days. You were fired at by people who had single-shot weapons, and you are unlikely to be affected by bullet splash in those conditions.
In Egypt, what type of equipment did you have there in the armoured car company?
When I first went there to the 12th armoured car, to the 3rd armoured car company. It was the 12th armoured car in Belfast. The 3rd armoured car company was the carryover of the Duke of Westminster's outfit, which was there during the war in Libya. And we had some of the same cars which were used by the Duke of Westminster, and they were again the, should I call it, Mark I Rolls-Royce.
Were they effective for what you
Yes, I think they would have been. They're there again. I was never called upon to fire from them, but we did a great deal of reconnaissance and driving in the desert over, in many cases, completely uncharted parts of the desert. And one had to be extremely careful about getting stuck with these things, because if you got stuck with 3.5 tons of Rolls-Royce, it might take you 2 hours to get out again by the use of digging channels with spades and putting down a sort of reinforced running board under the wheels for them to run out of their grave on.
So this form of Rolls-Royce armoured car was not particularly effective for the desert use?
No, except that it was relatively light. It was replaced as about 1927, I should say, early 1927, by a much more sophisticated model. But that, again, was a good deal heavier. I think this one weighed nearer 4.5 than 3.5 tons, and of course it only had the single wheels, though they were bigger tires than the earlier model. These were very much better if they had been involved in street fighting, because the armament and all was very much better against what was a likely form of attack in a crowd. But they were certainly no better over the desert. In fact, my impression is that they were rather worse, until we thought of the idea of putting twin wheels on the back, which you could do with the armoured wheels at that time, and then they performed fairly well.
Were you involved in the actual development of that idea?
Well, I don't think it was a development. We all said, let's stick some more wheels on, see if it goes any better. And it did. I think I'm right in saying that we also used to put twin wheels on the front when we knew we were going in soft desert and there were no roads about. It didn't improve the steering, but it improved the flotation of the thing a lot.
What was your principal job, in fact, at this time?
I was a section commander.
What was the job, in fact, of the armoured car company that you were...
Well, they were in support of the cavalry brigade, which was based at Abbasir Barracks alongside us.
Were you doing a peacekeeping role at this time?
No, not really. At that time, we were the major power in the Middle East, and we had troops in many Middle Eastern countries, notably, of course, Mesopotamia, where the Air Force were running armoured cars too. We were in Cairo in support of the forces which were there, which were there equally in a training role, I would have said, as in readiness for a minor outbreak of war, as in fact did occur when the early troubles in Palestine and a force from Cairo had to be sent up there under General Dobby to prevent the Arabs murdering the Jews. That was the type of thing we were there for.
Was the training in the armoured car company developed so that you were developing AFV tactics for deserts?
Oh, yes, very much more than it had been in England. And the commander of my company at that time was a very able man called Colonel Carter. He was a brevet colonel because the command was a major's command. And he did a great deal towards control of formations on the move in armour, and he developed the flag system of communication to a much higher state than it had been previously.
So you were having instructions, if you like, from him about how to use armoured cars in a desert situation?
Oh, yes, yes.
What would you say was the main difference between that sort of instruction tactics and what was going on in Belfast?
Well, Belfast was entirely slanted towards keeping order in streets, etc. In Cairo, it was not. We were thinking of possibly having to go over 100 miles of desert to repel possible insurgents. I don't know who they would be, but the only ones I can actually remember were herds of locusts.
Did you in fact set off and do such trips?
We did a lot of long distance travel in the desert. Not with any particular military object in view, because at that time in Egypt there was also British forces in the form of the Camel Corps, commanded by British officers, and it was their responsibility to take the first shock of any hostile action from any side. They had camels and they had motor vehicles.
And did you work with them?
Yes, but it would have been in support of them. They were under the control of the Egyptian authorities nominally, though of course it was very nominal because they were entirely officered by British officers who were in many cases drawn from ourselves. One or two of my brother officers at that time obtained secondment either to the Camel Corps or to the Transjordan Frontier Force.
What would you say was learnt for the use of AFVs in the desert from this period?
Well, the topography of the desert, navigation in the desert, and how to